on the record again, and I think, Mr. Colson, we were going to proceed first with your closing arguments, and I know you wanted to reserve a little bit of time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Examiner, and thank you, parties and counsel. There's no absolute right to a conditional use permit. Currently, it's specified in its title and acknowledged by the examiner in numerous rules in this case. SDCI is obligated to process Ocean Star's application in accordance with the requirements of SMC 25.09260, as well as SMC 23.42.042, which is specifically incorporated into 25.09260. 042 requires the director to exercise discretion to impose conditions to mitigate adverse impacts on the public interest in other properties when approving a conditional use, or to deny it if the adverse impacts cannot be mitigated satisfactorily. Against this legal background, the facts of this appeal demonstrate the director has completely failed to exercise the required discretion. Mr. Howson's testimony, confirmed today, could not be more clear that he believed the adverse impacts to the public interest and UJV, its view, and Admiral's House landmark status were outside the scope of his review, and he did not consider them. Ms. Carr also testified she did not consider any impacts on the view. These startling admissions were embraced by Ocean Star's architect. Mr. Drifdahl testified that the department had no discretion to limit the size or scale of the proposed project. Instead, what he called his client's program dictated those elements, and as long as he could meet the technical requirements in 2509260, his client's desires controlled the height and size of the buildings. The public meeting held on September 23rd is an alarming example, 2019 is an alarming example of the consequences of the abuse of discretion flowing from Mr. Houston's and Mr. Drifdahl's views of the SDCI role. Putting up a picture from Exhibit 25 and share my screen. The meeting was sought by over 75 community members who were told and believed they could present their concerns for consideration by SDCI in the planning process. Elizabeth Campbell testified to her interest at the meeting, the concerns she and others expressed, and watched as SCDI recorded the comments on butcher block paper for the group. Ms. Campbell testified at this appeal about expressing at the meeting concerns for the protection of the UJV view. Mr. Houston never informed the audience that view protection for UJV was outside the scope of his review. Mr. Drifdahl followed Mr. Houston. Here, he has written his email address and invited community members to contact him with concerns. He reassured the audience that the owners were invested in the community, and standing right in front of Ms. Campbell's recorded concern for the, quote, need legal document for view, close quotes, he told the audience that the owners were committed to protected views of UJV in accordance with the city's conditional approvals. Of course, he did not reveal his belief that his client's decisions dictated the height and size of the buildings. True to form, he testified in this appeal that the designs of the building, design of the buildings never changed after the design shown on the May 10, 2019 plan set that was present at the public meeting. Except there was one correction, and that was a notice from SDCI to add the north elevation of the plans, which showed the buildings prominently protruding into the UJV view. Given Mr. Drifdahl's testimony, you can certainly surmise that omission was not a coincidence. Debbie Mullins talked to Mr. Drifdahl for reassurance after the meeting and sent him an email with her detailed notes that are in Exhibit 26, asking for any corrections. Mr. Drifdahl never responded. Here's what the plans showed the owner's program was. On page 10 of City Exhibit 4, the conditioning living space in the two buildings is over 13,000 square feet, with a total living space of 27,640 square feet, almost four times the 7,316 feet of the Admiral's House. 10 bedrooms, 11.5 bathrooms, a shared pool and plaza, and underground parking for 13 cars. The max, the buildings imposed on the steep slope intrusion was calculated to be 90.2% of the maximum allowable intrusion. And the building's height was calculated to be 98.6% of the maximum allowable height. What's the cost to the public of this immense private benefit to the owners? First of all, it's the UJV view itself. Mr. Morin testified that the buildings block 30% to 40% of the view of a UJV visitor standing in the middle of the parking lot. This 30 to 40% blockage is at the completion of construction. As Ms. Keist and Mr. Stam acknowledged, the Amelanchier and Amifolia tree specified by Ocean Star will grow to 20 to 30 feet, resulting in 100% obliteration of the view, as shown in Appeal Exhibit 2. This was confirmed today by Ms. Carr's testimony. The public cost of the projects is also dwarfing the Admiral's House, as shown on the south elevation of City Exhibit 4, May 17. Ocean Star admits that the buildings take away the prominence of the Admiral's House on the site, one of the three criteria designated as a landmark. Just like the square footage comparisons on this exhibit elevation itself, the buildings appear to be 3 to 4 times the size of the Admiral's House, which is shown in the dotted whited out area in the lower right-hand corner. The MCC has proven the immense adverse public impact resulting from this unrestricted maximum private gain that Mr. Houston admits he ignored. MCC has also proven the strong public interest in UJV and its views in the public. First of all, Ms. Keith testified about UJV being part of the Olmsted legacy from 1903. For Seattle Parks. Ms. Campbell testified to the community efforts to obtain the land for UJV and the significance of naming it for such an outstanding community activist as Ursula Judkins. And Ms. Examiner, I thank you for going through Exhibit 33 to learn more about that yourself. The community and MCC's efforts to improve and protect the park was also outlined in the testimony of Debbie and Jean Mullins, who have been a constant participate in that process. MCC has also approved the view impacts. Evidence from Ms. Keast and the city that the view of the Ursula Judkins viewpoint is the entire southern boundary. Ms. Keast explained that in her sketch, Exhibit 8, that shows access to the view across the entire southern boundary. And the Parks and Recreation website, admitted as Exhibit 23, shows the same full view across the entire boundary. Ocean Star, however, claims to be making the view better by taking out trees. We want to look at City Exhibit 4, page 19. As Mr. Stan, Drib Dog, Mr. Stan admitted, however, the only reason the trees are coming out and comparing between the two views is so the buildings could be constructed. The claim also completely ignores the fact that without view protection sought by MCC, the entire view that they propose to make better will be obscured in just a few short years. More importantly, the photo is deceiving in the upper right-hand corner of page 19. Ms. Keast and the Mullins testified about the tendency for people to gravitate to the southern border of the park for the best view. The view covenant envisioned someone sitting in a lawn chair, or even a wheelchair, at that southern border. However, Ocean Star's picture is taken from the top of the asphalt, near the top of the asphalt parking lot, a dangerous and unpopular place to sit in a wheelchair or a lawn chair. So, at the southern boundary, you would be sitting behind an 8-foot fence, looking at what are known to be 8-foot Amelanchier or Amifolia trees, and a building 100% view loss from that point. Despite Mr. Stan's efforts to pivot the cultivars at this hearing, which would, as Ms. Carr testified, require SDCI approval to switch from trees to shrubs under that mitigation plan, those trees soon will grow to 20 to 30 feet and obliterate you even higher in the park. And Ms. Carr confirmed that though that approval would be required, and I know it would be in a forum where the public has no right to review or comment on those on that approvals. MCC has also proven the impact on the Admiral's House landmark status. Eugenia Wu's career landmark and historic building professional, and currently the executive director of Historic Seattle, testified that the goal of the landmark status was to protect and preserve the public interest in landmarks for the benefit of the public. She also testified that Historic Seattle held an historic preservation easement over the Admiral's House in Exhibit 11 and its associated landmark area. She testified that the Admiral's House met three of the six factors for designation as a landmark, including the hardest one, factor of F, relating to the prominence of its special location, the contrast of its siting, age, and scale, and easily identifiable visual feature on its lot. Based on the size, location, and scale of the proposed building, she concluded that the buildings would have an adverse impact on the Admiral's House landmark status. I'm sorry, we're going to have to pull that up. Exhibit 4, page 17. Clearly be seen the proposed buildings completely overruled the Admiral's House on that, and were put in the photos that have been made part of the record in this case. She also testified, though, the proposed buildings would diminish the Admiral's House status on the National Register of Historic Places. Through Mr. Morey and Ms. Keyes, MCC has also presented ample evidence of conditions that would mitigate these adverse impacts. Mr. Stamm and Mr. Grubal testified that the design intent was not to obstruct the UJB views. However, both admitted nothing in the CUP required assurance that the view would be preserved, and Ms. Carr has confirmed that in her testimony today. Given OceanStar's five-year refusal to remove the razor wire they placed unlawfully on UJB property, and relying on an unwritten design intent from OceanStar would be very problematic and would not constitute the mitigation required under SMC 23.42.042. But Mr. Morey in this case did talk about the appropriate mitigation conditions. First of all, eliminating the third floor. Second, moving the buildings 8 feet down and 8 feet to the west. Another possibility, although there were obstacles, was regrading UJB itself so that it would overcome the 8-foot plus intrusion and the 20 to 30 foot intrusion of the trees. This case suggested moving the trees and imposed view protection from the remaining shrubs in the buffer. And of course, you can eliminate the north stair access, which is designed and shown without any approval of Seattle Parks and Recreation. In summary, MCC is established by a preponderance of the evidence the project's adverse impacts on the public interest, UJB, and its views, and the Admiral's House landmark status. By treating those impacts as outside the scope of its review, Mr. Houston has manifestly refused to exercise any discretion under SMC 23.14.042. The decision is thus an abuse of discretion. The examiner should deny the application outright under subsection C, or reverse and remand the application for proper review by SDCI. I want to add a personal note. Two of the personal benefits of getting involved in this field have been, first, getting to know and appreciate the passion and care of my neighbors and the members of the Magnolia Community Council. But the other was learning more about the legend and leadership of Ursula Judkins in protecting valuable public assets in our community. And I believe Ursula Judkins and her spirit are with us all today. We need to do her proud in protecting UJB and making it worth of her name. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coulson. Ms. Kaler, did you wish to go next, or Mr. Houston? I'm not sure which was the preferred order.
I'm happy to go next.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Examiner. Courtney Kayla representing Ocean Star, the applicant. MCC has failed to demonstrate either legal or factual error on the part of SDCI. We will address the legal issues in our briefing, but suffice to say that SDCI was both allowed to and in fact required to follow the Seattle Municipal Code in making this decision, and it did so. Today, I'm going to focus on the factual issues and why MCC failed to prove its case to demonstrate that any additional conditions are needed or appropriate on this permit. First, with regard to views. While not code required, the applicant took great care to design the project to both preserve and actually improve views from Ursula Judkins Park, as Mr. Drivdahl testified. And I will share my screen. Ocean Star Exhibit 12, which is also part of the plan set in this matter, shows both the before and the after condition. The before condition shown here, and apologies while I move the attempt to move my, there we go. The before condition shown here, and the after condition shown on the next page. As you can see from this exhibit, the top of only a portion of the roof of the project is barely visible from Ursula Judkins Park after development. And the view of the water is actually substantially expanded horizontally. In the before image, trees significantly block that view to the right-hand side of the telephone pole, and in the after image, this view is significantly widened and opened up. As Mr. Drivdahl testified, well outside the scope of any view covenant. And this view, this after view, is the result of mitigation being built into the project here. So first, Ocean Star proposed homes with a reduced height well below what is allowed by code, as Mr. Drivdahl testified. And Ocean Star Exhibit 12, the third page, shows what could be allowed with peaked roofs built to a maximum height. So the project in and of itself is mitigating view impacts by reducing height significantly below what would be allowed by code as of right. And in addition, there is a significantly increased setback from the property line with Ursula Judkins' viewpoint. So the property line is, there is a 5-foot setback required from the property line, as is dimensioned on City Exhibit 4, PDF page 16, that's sheet A205, there is a minimum setback of 24 feet to the buildings in this case. There's a substantial additional setback dimensioned on the plan I just referenced and then shown here on City Exhibit 4, PDF page 11. And the setback moves the house down the slope and really sets the house into the slope, so that only a very small portion of the roof is visible from Ursula Judkins Park, and a small portion of the home itself is even above the elevation of the lowest point at Ursula Judkins Park. And then finally, as shown in the rendering, the landscaping is sensitively designed to open up the view. MCC has criticized the location from which this photo is taken, but it is in fact not at the entry to the parking lot. It is really in the middle of the park, as is shown on the key that goes with this photograph. And this is, as Mr. Driftdahl testified, the best view from the park. And it was chosen as being representative of the best view. As Mr. Houston testified, and as the municipal code, section 2390.002, provides, it's not just the condition that is placed on a MUP that is binding, it's also the contents of the MUP plans. And here, the MUP plans themselves demonstrate what has been testified to by multiple applicant witnesses, the applicant's intent to both preserve and enhance the view from Ursula Judkins Park. So MCC has expressed concern about the height of the homes, but as previously stated, they are well under zoned height. MCC has expressed concerns about the role of Amelanchier. And there's been quite a bit of testimony in this hearing about those particular trees. As Mr. Stam testified, the applicant's intent is to provide a cultivar of Amelanchier that is lower growing. And Ms. Carr today testified that so long as the ecological value of the mitigation plan is maintained, that can be approved as part of the construction plan process. And MCC has also referenced, only briefly in closing, the view and landscape maintenance covenant that was put in place by a prior property owner. As the examiner knows, the examiner lacks jurisdiction to interpret or apply that covenant. But there, even if the examiner could consider it, it does not support MCC's argument here. The covenant on its face benefits only the property owner and specifically says that it's there to provide the privacy, shade, slope, and soil stability benefits of the trees to the property owner. It also exempts landscaping for slope stability, and it exempts landscaping that is needed to comply with code. And here, the uncontested evidence in the record shows that trees do provide slope stability. We heard that from Ms. Carr this morning. As well, City Exhibit 7, pages 12, 16, and 25 refer to the slope stability benefits provided by trees. And in fact, the evidence shows that MCC here is really not seeking mitigation for the impacts of this project. What MCC is seeking is an improvement to the existing view. This is really illustrated best by MCC's Exhibit 31 on pages 2 and then pages 3 to 4. This is an email exchange with Mr. Mullins and a former property owner. And in that email, which is dated 2011, so 2 years before this owner even purchased the property, Mr. Mullins wrote that the Navy had historically allowed trees and bushes to grow uncontrollably behind the Admiral's house adjacent to the park, blocking views from the park. That blackberries had grown higher than the fence and were obscuring views, as he said they do each year. And the people had to climb on the fence to get photos. These are the exact same conditions that we have heard MCC address in testimony in this hearing that exists today. So the view from the park and the fact that there is landscaping that obscures part of the view, that is not a project impact. That's an existing condition. And the project is not responsible for mitigating existing conditions. It is responsible only for addressing its own impacts, which it has done thoroughly by measures that are incorporated into the project design. With regard to the Admiral's House, it is uncontested here that the project avoids the landmarked area entirely. The construction won't even impact the landmarked area. As Mr. Drivedahl testified, there is shoring included in the plans to ensure that all construction stays out of the landmark boundary. And MCC's witness, Mr. Mooring, acknowledged that with shoring it was feasible to stay outside the boundary. The project does not impact the lawn below the Admiral's House, which is a landmarked area and what provides the unobstructed view of Admiral's House from the water and downtown and Queen Anne. Still, MCC claims that the project will impact the prominence of location of the Admiral's House, but this is based entirely on a photo from a cruise ship, which is elevated and not representative of views that are common of the Admiral's House. Instead, the views that will be seen from the Admiral's House are best depicted, the views that will be seen of the Admiral's House post-construction are best depicted in the plan set itself, which I will share now. This is City Exhibit 4 and it's PDF page 23. This is a view from the street that runs below the Admiral's House, and we can see that the open lawn is completely unobstructed by the project, and the Admiral's House is still quite prominent on the hillside. It was just a little bit of a peekaboo view of the very tops of the roofs of the project behind. And this preservation of the Admiral's House prominence, as Mr. Drivedahl testified, is preserved through a number of elements of the project design. First, contrary to the argument we heard today, these projects are actually on scale with the Admiral's House. As Mr. Drivedahl testified, each of the homes is about the same square footage as Admiral's House. They are consistent with it. They are set back from the Admiral's House, as we saw on the elevations that the sections that I showed earlier. And there's a substantial treed buffer in between the Admiral's House and the project, which is not shown on the architectural exhibit that was shown earlier in oral argument by MCC. The homes are built lower than permitted by code. They are built into the hillside, and they're clustered together to preserve substantial open space around them. Finally, the Admiral's House is already set in a single-family neighborhood. In fact, Mr. Mullen's house sits quite prominently above the Admiral's House under existing conditions. Ms. Wu's testimony was relating solely to one criteria for landmark designation, and she acknowledged Admiral's House is designated based on three criteria, and a designation requires only one. So, there is absolutely no impact here to the designated status of the Admiral's House, and MCC has failed to demonstrate that any additional conditions are required relating to landscape, relating to landmark issues. So in conclusion, the city properly considered and conditioned this project. MCC has failed to demonstrate that any additional conditions are necessary, and the applicant requests that the examiner affirm the master use permit. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kaler. Mr. Halston?
Thank you, Ms. Examiner. Just to start, and I'll be brief, but the city issued a director's decision for a master use permit. The proposal is for two single-family homes in the portion of the property that is zoned for single family. The review included compliance with single family zoning as part of the review. There are environmentally critical areas present on the site. The one that that required some additional consideration have to do with the steep slopes and the amount of steep slope area that is present on the site and the amount of intrusion into the steep slope zone or steep slope areas. as part of the project review and process. Public comments were taken, reviewed, and considered to the extent that they were within the scope of the review. Comments were also received that are beyond the scope of the review and analysis. Going through the decision, which again the department issued and stands behind, there's the analysis I think speaks for itself, but just wanted to note that the proposal does include elements to protect other properties by fully stabilizing the building site, preserving the designated landmark and remaining outside of the landmark boundary, and the ECA mitigation plan includes plantings to compensate for the impacts to the ECA. So the project as proposed was approved with conditions. That condition is to record the non-disturbance boundary that is shown both in the plan set but then also in the city exhibit. And so that will maintain the intrusion into the steep slope areas by development. That's the finding and conclusion of SDCI. So with that, I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. Mr. Coulson, you have some additional closing remarks.
Thank you very much, Ms. Zenner. I'll be brief. 100% of the private gain from this project is dictated by the owners of the property at the 100% expense of Ursula Judkins' viewpoint and the Admiral's House, without any discretion required by 23.42.042 to mitigate those impacts. We believe MCC has established by a preponderance of the evidence the project's adverse impacts on the public interest, UJV and its views, and the Admiral's House landmark status. We believe we've also established by a preponderance of the evidence, and it's basically unrefuted, because there's been no discretion exercised to mitigate the devastating impacts of that. We ask that the examiner correct that travesty. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coulson. All right, so I think at this point, we should probably set deadlines for closing briefs. And this is, of course, to address the legal aspect of this and in particular, the discretion to address impacts outside the CEO through 2342. Parties have thoughts on when those should be due? And I can't recall now what additional I stated on that, but we probably should set some page limits. And then I assume this is simultaneous briefing, but... And so with both parties submitting a closing brief on a date set maybe a week or two from now, but I want to hear from the parties and what you'd like to do.
Thank you, Ms. Examiner. We would have a slight preference for the typical order of briefing where the appellant would brief first and we would respond, simply because we are in a responsive position here and want to be sure we're understanding the arguments. But if it's the examiner's preference to have simultaneous briefing, of course, would defer to that. And a couple of weeks is sufficient time for us.
Mr. Coulson, Mr. Schneider?
I'll go first, I guess. I think simultaneous briefing is the most appropriate in this case, given that it is typical and how what the issues are. And I believe 2 weeks would be adequate for me.
Mr. Houston, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm sorry, I'll let Mr. Schneider speak for himself.
Oh, okay. Mr. Schneider, did you have anything to add on that?
No, I'll defer to Ted on this issue. Thank you.
And then Mr. Houston.
Yeah, I guess a question, you know, for the city. I guess we would like the option to also provide, you know, a closing brief on this issue and what's being discussed as far as a couple weeks works for the city.
Okay. I'm wondering, I mean, if we did simultaneous, it does seem like there might need to be an opportunity for reply. And I'm not sure that it matters to me either way, whether it's simultaneous or just, although, but it seems like there may need a reply if we do it that way. Otherwise, you would have the appellant go first, followed by the applicant, and then maybe a reply. Maybe it's most efficient for everyone to submit one and then do a reply. Any immediate thoughts on that? I'm not sure I have a strong preference either way on this, but it does seem like if we do file all at once, you would need a reply opportunity.
Ms. Examiner, I did have another recent case where we did simultaneous briefs and simultaneous, I don't know if you would call them responses or replies.
Yeah.
And that would work for the applicant.
Mr. Colson, Mr. Schneider, anything to add on that?
Well, given the work that's gone in there, I think simultaneous briefings by themselves are all right. Would be preferred.
Okay. Well, I think...
Any lawyer, any time, can find something more to talk about.
Well, there's probably a bit of truth to that, but I think what we'll do, it kind of this in between, where we'll have a simultaneous deadline and then a shorter reply brief, and that's just to address if they're, because I don't know exactly kind of how the parties are going to frame their arguments on this, and I don't think, and the parties likewise probably don't know exactly how things will be structured. So I think that's how we'll set it. So we'll have initial reply briefs, and what we set that maybe our initial closing and then a reply. So maybe 2 weeks out from today. Today is what, the 21st, so maybe October 5th. Does that work for the parties? Or the 4th, either? Or
5th works for MCC.
Okay, so October 4th then maybe. And then October 5th, and then a reply maybe a week later on the 12th. Any concerns with that?
No concerns from the applicant.
Okay. All right. Mr. Houston, these deadlines are the same for the city as well. So.
Yep. Yeah,
and then, do I need to set limits on page length? Sometimes that's a good idea.
I'll weigh in and request your page limit.
Okay.
I think everyone benefits from the discipline. I would propose 5 pages for the opening and 2 for the reply. But again, I defer to Ted if he feels differently for MCC.
Other thoughts? Is that sufficient, or do you need more?
For the applicant, I also appreciate page limits, but I think that's a little light for this case, and so I guess I would suggest doubling that.
Okay, so maybe like 10 and 5 or something like that.
That would work for the applicant.
Just to clarify, we're being asked to brief a single legal issue, correct?
That is true. It is a single legal issue. It doesn't get into like the facts and so forth for the most part. I mean, but yes, you're correct. This is a single legal issue. Tell you what, how about 8 and 4? That's kind of somewhat in between. I think that probably is sufficient. Okay, so October 5 for the simultaneous briefs, October 12th for the reply, page limits of 8, and then 4 for the reply. And my decision, of course, is out within 15 days, calendar days, of the receipt of the briefs. Just FYI, if there's anything that the parties file, like a motion for reconsideration or something, after my decision issues, please also alert Mr. Edlund's show that something's been filed. We have a glitch in the system. It should be rectified by then, but we weren't receiving notice of any filings after the decision. I think we'll get that fixed promptly, but just in case it hasn't for whatever reason, that practice might be helpful for us. All right, I think that's it. Are there any other procedural issues that we need to address this morning?
None from me, Ms. Examiner. Thank you very much.
Okay.
None from the applicant.
Okay, Mr. Edlund Cho, I'm sorry, did I interrupt Mr. Houston?
No, none from the city.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Edlund Cho, is there anything else that I need to address?
I would like a copy of applicant exhibit 13.
Okay.
Which was marked as.
I will email that here at the close of the hearing.
Okay. And just so the parties know, Mr. Edlund Cho, putting together an exhibit list that includes all the exhibits. And there will be a renumbering. That's just how the hearing examiner's office does it. But the parties in briefing, you may continue. In fact, it's easier for me to use the briefing that you all have used. The numbering that you all have used with appellant, 123, department 123, and so forth. Even though we'll have this master list that'll have everything, just very simply one through whatever the last exhibit number is. Are there any questions on that?
Ms. Examiner, I am sorry. I did think to ask for admissions of the exhibits, MCC's exhibits 27, 28, 29. Those were the initial plans. They were testified to by Mr. Grifdahl. I'm not sure.
I thought 27, 28, and 29 were withdrawn. That's what my notes say.
Right. I'm asking that they be admitted. We withdrew them. We anticipated we'd use them as an impeachment. But they came up during Mr. Grimwald's testimony.
Okay, I don't recall if there wasn't. I know at the front end of this there were some objections on several exhibits. I don't know if those were among those that were objected to.
Those were objected to, and I guess I would further object to a party asking for admission of exhibits after its case is closed. Those were. Mr. Drifdahl did not specifically testify regarding those exhibits, and since they were not presented at MCC's case, we did not have the opportunity to provide any responsive testimony to them, which we likely would have done had there been a request for their admission at the outset. So I would continue to object to those exhibits.
Clearly, we've done our case, and we're not going to refer to it, but Mr. Grifdahl specifically talked about those and then took great credit for the fact that he supposedly scaled them down to then produce the current proposed plans.
And Mr. Grifdahl did not testify regarding those specific exhibits.
Yeah, I think it's a bit late since they were withdrawn, at least according to my notes on that. It's a bit late in the proceeding to change that. So I'm not going to go ahead and admit those just due to the lateness and the fact that they were earlier withdrawn. Any other questions from the parties?
Not from MCC.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. I appreciate the focus of the hearing testimony, keeping in on the issues that are before me. Very, very much appreciate that. I think that's it. We are adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I was
recording stopped.
I was going to mention that we figured out the source of the interference.